Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau can't make it this week, but that's okay because we've got former Facebook CISO and current Stanford adjunct professor Alex Stamos filling in for him. In today's show, he'll be joining us in just a moment to talk through all the week's security news. And then it's time for this week's sponsor interview with David Warburton of F5 Networks. And it's interesting times for F5 right now. You might remember them as a blinky light box manufacturer. Load balancers, SSL termination, that sort of stuff, which is not exactly a growth industry at the moment. So they're kind of pivoting. They've dropped $670 million on Nginx. F5 now owns the Nginx company, and they're making all sorts of moves into the AppSec space. That interview is mostly about F5's business, but you know, I found it interesting because what do you do when you're an $8 billion company that makes data center equipment and that industry starts going into decline? That's this week's sponsor interview coming up later. But before all of that, it is time to look back on the week's security news with our good friend Alex Stamos. And Alex, I guess the story that's got everyone's arms flapping around this week is the New York Times report looking at the ransomware attack that has crippled the Baltimore City government and kind of apportioning a fair bit of blame for that event to NSA, because the malware apparently, or the attackers apparently, made use of the Eternal Blue exploit, which was leaked by shadow brokers. What did you make of this story?
There seems to be a lot of anger about what seems to be a pretty straightforward story in the New York Times. You know, Nicole Perroth and Scott Chain. Nicole's a longtime cybersecurity reporter. Scott Chain is somewhat famous for his Inside the Beltway intelligence community reporting. And they talk about how a pretty standard financially motivated crypto locker has ruined a bunch of machines for the city of Baltimore, and how one of the exploits used by it is Eternal Blue. Coming out of that, then, is a huge amount of anger from a number of folks who thought that they're putting a little too much blame on the NSA and that the blame should rather be apportioned mostly to the city of Baltimore. And it seems to me that there's a little bit of blame to go around for everybody here. And I'm not sure why there's so much anger about kind of a reasonable update on how powerful Eternal Blue is still 2 years later. There was a specific argument over whether Eternal Blue was part of this at all. And Nicole has doubled down that they have checked with their sources who worked on the incident response. I have absolute faith that two reporters of that caliber would not be printing a specific fact like that. So then the argument becomes about how much responsibility is there to be given out to NSA versus the city. And you know, from my perspective, this whole couple of years since the shadow brokers has been really fascinating, because the whole idea of the vulnerabilities equities process, the VEP, is the idea that you're trying to balance all of these equities against each other when you don't have very good data about what is probable, right? And we've learned two really good data points since shadow brokers. One, before shadow brokers, I would not give the odds of the NSA losing a trove of very stable, very high quality exploits as very high. And it turns out that that percentage should be quite high, right? Of the idea of if you build exploits, the possibility of them leaking is actually pretty good. And then the second is that the patch timelines are, as much as we've talked about patch timelines being bad, they are as bad or worse than we've all been saying for a long time. Yeah. And so those are two good data points. And I think, you know, they're not saying it is only NSA's fault, but I do think it is true that the government overall has not reckoned with the outcome of shadow brokers, which I think has honestly set back the NSA's reputation a little bit.
Well, but I mean, that was why shadow brokers leaked this stuff in the first place, was exactly so we would be here having this conversation, right? Right. Not to say that it's a conversation we shouldn't have, but that was the idea, is to have them sort of having to fend off accusations of carelessness, maybe face more oversight, more regulation, that sort of stuff. But look, I mean, one thing that I immediately thought of when all of this was breaking is like, okay, it's 2 years later and we're still banging on about this one exploit. Like, immediately what came to mind for me was MS-08067, which was another SMB bug that was like around forever, and everybody using it for years and years and years, kind of had a similar impact. So I started tweeting about this, saying, you know, hey, look, MS-08067 was just another one of these. Like, it didn't come from the NSA, but it did cause a bunch of headaches. This is maybe no different. Like, an exploit is an exploit is an exploit. Maybe if it had gone through the VEP process, someone would have reverse engineered the patch and released an exploit via Metasploit or something like that, we'd be right back here. Now, this actually kicked off a bit of a debate. One person I spoke to about this was Mark Dowd, who knows a thing or two about computer exploits, right? And he said to me,
look... Yes, I would say so.
Yeah, and he's like, look, you know, I think people are kind of too lazy to really work on something. He said, without that exploit as an actual starting point, like, there was a lot of work that went into making that one work against various different versions of Windows and make it reliable. So he doesn't think that if this bug had have gone through the VEP process or just had have been patched by some other means that it would necessarily have resulted in an exploit. And then, you know, I was sort of relaying his thoughts without his name attached to them on Twitter. And then Dave Itell jumps in and he's like, that's bullshit. You know, like people reverse patches all the time. You know, there's plenty of people in the community who would have done that. So we, you know, it's entirely possible that if it had gone through the VEP process, we'd be exactly where we are. And I think that's an interesting debate, but both sides of that argument, we're just speculating, right? No one can be provably right in discussing a hypothetical like that.
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for Dave Itell. I was a colleague of his back at Netstake. I think Dave has a little bit of a blind spot when it comes to this kind of stuff, because the truth is he trades in high quality exploits. And so whenever there's a discussion when it comes to controlling those exploits or the downsides of them, when there's a discussion about NSO group or export controls, Dave jumps in very aggressively in a way that in this case, I think is definitely not appropriate. And, you know, there's a lot of blame to go around here. You can't not patch Windows machines for 2 years. That's absolutely true. But I got to agree with Mark, too. The odds of there being an exploit of this quality available to CryptoLocker scammers is probably not that great if you had an appropriate vet process by which this was patched well before the exploit came out. Now, that doesn't mean it wouldn't get exploited by anybody. I do think there's an interesting question of, in those situations where the VEP is used and the patch is issued, are there now MSS, PLA, SVR, GRU hackers who do have the R&D capabilities and whose people are not lazy because this is their full-time job, who are now utilizing those exploits. But that, you know, in those cases, most of those agencies, unlike the NSA in this case, don't lose those exploits on the public market. And so you don't end up seeing it in just standard crimeware. So yeah. It's not a super simple issue.
No, it's not. But regardless of this one, right? What made me sort of backtrack a little on my MS-08067, you know, thought bubble there was exploits are getting more complicated, right? So in the future, NSA, in order to have successful exploit chains against, you know, contemporary targets, those exploits just by necessity are going to become things that have a lot of R&D go into them, right? So they're not going to be the sort of things that the community just sort of replicates on the weekend because they like to write exploits or like to write Metasploit modules or whatever, or, you know, Dave's guys doing, you know, Canvas exploits. So I think that, you know, in the future, the argument that would assign blame in a similar set of circumstances in the future, the argument that would assign more blame to NSA will actually get stronger, right? Because the fact will be that exploits, public domain exploits are kind of going away, right? Because they're just so complicated.
But that's also an excuse for them not to give up the exploits, right? Like, if they have to invest $30 million of taxpayer money into a chain of four exploits to own up, you know, fully patch Windows 10 in the future, then... if I was them, I would not want to give that up very quickly.
No, but I mean,
to protect people.
Why would they, right? Like, unless an adversary is using an exploit, you know, like, why would you actually VEP anything?
Yeah, no, it's totally true. This comes back to who is making this decision and who is representing industry and users. And that's always been my question through the VEP, is it does not seem to me that the highly competent people at the table, the highly technical people, it doesn't feel to me that they're on the side of the normal user. They are probably coming from NSA and Cyber Command, and they're going up against some mid-level, well-meaning bureaucrats from DHS or Commerce or the like. And, you know, the structure of the VEP and how it works inside, for all the things now, obviously, complaining about the functioning of the U.S. administration right now, this is a minor issue compared to all the other things that's going on in the U.S., but it would be nice to see a little more transparency about how these decisions are getting made.
Sure, sure. But I mean, you would agree, I'm sure, that NSA is not going to give up the ability to have exploit chains that target Windows systems, and nor should they, right?
No. So
where does this leave us, right? Like, I don't think this whole episode, and this is where I kind of think some of the criticism of the New York Times piece is valid, is what would you have NSA do about this? And they're saying, you know, Nicole has used words in her Twitter feed, and I think this is where some of the criticism directed toward her is coming from. She's used words like smoldering hellscape in tweets and talked about stockpiling. And I think that sort of misses the point a little bit, right? Like, organizations like NSA, SIGINT agencies tasked with doing this sort of stuff, they are going to have exploits. It is unrealistic to demand that they VEP functioning exploits. Like, why would they do that?
Have the two of us just completely turned around, talked ourselves around on this issue? Are we like recruiting for NSA now and believe that, you know, go government contractors like
No, but I mean, you hear what I'm saying, right? Like, what would the people who are talking about this being some evidence of NSA stockpiling dangerous, it should have been VEPPed. Like, what would you have NSA do differently, right? Like, the core of it is they shouldn't have lost that exploit. And I agree with people like yourself who are saying there needs to be maybe a little bit more public explanation about what went wrong there. But it's possible they just don't know, right? It is possible they don't know exactly what's happened here. But, you know, geez, they got played hard, right? Let's face it. And it was almost certainly a foreign adversary who was behind this. And a lot of work went into stealing this stuff.
Right. I think what this whole thing demonstrates is it's bad to not help Microsoft patch a flaw. It is 100 times worse to let your exploit go. That is a much, much worse outcome than stockpiling and keeping it safe.
Yeah. I don't know, though. It's like people sort of assume that NSA was like really YOLO with its exploits. And I don't think that's necessarily the case.
We haven't had any public discussion. I mean, this continues to be a frustrating part is that there's, you know, sources and methods and such, but this is the kind of, if NSA is going to lose exploits, then they're going to have to give up a little bit of their privacy and declassify some stuff on how they handle and what their internal processes are, right? Like, you know, that kind of secrecy of how you work internally works great until you screw up like this on this stage.
Yeah.
Now it's time for them to explain to Congress and explain to the American people, like, this is how we're not going to make this mistake again.
Yeah, no, I think that's reasonable. And, you know, we got a late breaking story here from Sean Gallagher over at Ars, where apparently Baltimore City leaders are now blaming NSA for the ransomware attack, which is a nice bit of buck passing there. There's even like media reports in Baltimore saying that the malware was developed by NSA. So look, that report is controversial for a reason, right?
Yeah, one of their politicians said NASA first, so maybe I'm not going to rely upon the Baltimore City Council to figure this out. I mean, another interesting thing in this story is that the budget for IT in the city of Baltimore is 2.5% of their budget, which is clearly, for an organization that needs to massively upgrade their technology, is clearly not enough.
I blame Carchetti.
Exactly. Right.
It's Carchetti. Yes. He only cares about moving up the chain politics. He started out all right, but it's Carchetti's fault. I reckon about maybe 20% of the audience are going to get that reference, but good for you for understanding it, Alex.
I watched every season.
Yes. All right, moving on. And look, staying with the theme of bugs. And, you know, I just love it when a chaotic actor sort of comes along and just shakes things up. But, you know, we alluded to it last week. I think I mentioned on last week's show with Adam that the internet persona known as Sandbox Escaper had dropped another LPE for Windows 10. That's now turned into a bunch of LPEs for Win 10. What do we know about these bugs?
Well, this is a pretty amazing run here. 3 days in a row, 8-0 days,
you know,
in 10 months.
Keep in mind, 5 minutes ago, we're talking about how people are lazy and don't write exploits. And then, you know, next story is someone has just written 8 of them in 10 months and a bunch of them in the last week.
8 of them in 10 months.
Yeah.
All pretty impressive. Local privilege escalation. Now, as all of our listeners know, the local attack surface on Windows continues to be incredibly massive, right? For anybody who has picked up the Windows Internals book, the Rusinovich book, the fact that the first volume of that book is like 800 pages and it takes him 5 years to write the second volume, he can never write the second volume in time for the next version of Windows, kind of shows you how much internal attack surface there is, because that's all about the different APIs that you can call. often as a low-priv user or even from inside, you know, what their sandboxes are. So anyway, lots of good exploits. The thing I love is that these are all going up onto GitHub anonymously, and Microsoft owns GitHub now. So I think that's a fantastic little touch, which I'm guessing that the she's not hitting GitHub from her actual cell phone or personal DSL line. But we don't know a lot about this person, or she has some pretty decent privacy.
I've done a bit of Googling, and, you know, she has history, right? Doing things through ZDI, stuff like that, like years ago. So I was like wondering if this was some sort of, you know, SIGINT troll or something. And nope, it looks like it's just one person who's very good at doing, you know, sandbox bypasses on Windows.
But it's interesting, if she did ZDI before, why is she giving the stuff away for free now? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
That it seems that these are all, you know, these aren't $1 million bugs, but you could probably, especially if you package them all up and your exploits are nice and stable, I bet you could sell this package to a decent number of buyers.
100%, man. And there is demand out there for Windows 10 privesks, like 100%, to make the other stuff work well.
Which is a good sign for Microsoft, right? Microsoft's done a lot of work on pushing privileges down. You know, if you open a Process Explorer on a modern, brand new Windows 10 box, it's 100 times better than you saw in like the Windows 2003 era.
Yeah. Well, that's not hard, right? Now, look, yeah. I missed this one last week. It's kind of an old story, but Cyber Command did dump a bunch more malware samples onto VirusTotal. I love it when they do this. I think this is super cool. Because it was like, this one was an active campaign. I think it was a Russian campaign. They've just burned it down, like, by VTing it. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's just a bizarre world that we live in, that a component of the United States military, that the way they establish deterrence to their adversaries
is to dox them.
is to dox them to a Google-owned, an Alphabet-owned product, and therefore to get all of their stuff into virus scanners, including Kaspersky's. It's great to see. I mean, I love the idea of Cyber Command interacting with the community this way and giving back. You know, something that I have been a public critic of both NSA and Cyber Command is it does feel that they're all offense all the time, that their incentive structure is really aimed towards attacking America's adversaries. And so to see them kind of actively participating in defense in a way that helps a lot of people magically and automatically without those individuals doing something, you know, a ton of...
Yeah, they just, I mean, that's like automatically evict people out of the networks, right? Like, the classification, like a lot of people, you know, from a distance might not realize that this is a huge policy change, right? Because this kind of involves declassifying what is essentially a whole bunch of really super secret squirrel counterintelligence work, right? To then just grab those samples and go YOLO and VirusTotal them, that's a huge change. And I think it's, look, I think it's cool because it's funny. It's fun to talk about.
Yeah, it also, once again, highlights how smart Google was to pick up VirusTotal and to build Chronicle around it.
Yeah.
You know, because now they effectively have a whole intelligence solution that is apparently the official outlet of U.S. Cyber Command.
That's it. Now, look, of course, we got to talk about this one this week. You know, Julian Assange, a few weeks ago, you know, finally came out of that embassy and there was the CFAA charge against him. And the reaction from most of the sort of, you know, media and at least the national security law establishment was like, well, this is good. There's no First Amendment problems here. It's a computer fraud and abuse, you know, conspiracy charge. No problem. Now, of course, the US government had 65 days to lodge a superseding indictment, and they have. Now, this is the indictment under the Espionage Act that a lot of people have been very worried was coming. The Obama-era Department of Justice decided not to pursue these charges because of the First Amendment challenges, the thinking being that, you know, if this test case was brought and won by DOJ, it would actually criminalize practices that are engaged in by journalists. That's a view that I happen to agree with, and I've long said on the show that even though I'm no fan of Julian Assange, I would be the first one to condemn these types of charges against him as being an absolutely terrible idea. Sure enough, the charges have landed, and I do think it's an absolutely terrible idea, because what if Assange is convicted under these charges, essentially what it does is makes reporting on anything that's sort of classified national defense information, it makes the third party, you know, whether that's a journalist, whether that's a leaks website, it criminalizes the publication of national defense information. So that really means that, you know, let's think about that for a second. That means that governments, in order to essentially shield their wrongdoing from the press All they need to do is classify it. You know, job done. It's dangerous. This is really dangerous. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I totally agree. As much as it pains me to defend Assange.
so many people are in that situation this week.
Oh, this is, you know, that, there's a saying in the US, right? Bad defendants create bad law.
Yeah.
And this is certainly DOJ. You know, there's been a whole host of leaks. And as much as I'd love to put this just on the shoulders of the Trump administration, the real crackdown on leaks and secrecy started during the Obama administration. There's basically the national security state has, since the Snowden disclosures, really, you know, decided they want to turn the clock back, I think, a little bit on the effectiveness of national security reporting as driven from classified leaks. The truth is there's been way more leaking over the last 5 years, you know, than there was before. I think Snowden was a little bit of a watershed for individuals, right? And it seems that the fact that the reality winners and such have been caught has not deterred future government leakers. I think there's also been a lot of politically motivated leaking. I think that's part of it, too, is that we see more partisanship now of people that who are professional civil service who see themselves on one side or the other, and they are more likely to violate classification rules because they feel that things are overclassified.
Polarization driving leaks. That makes sense. I buy it. Yep.
I think that is part of it. But whatever the goal, I mean, it felt to me that they had Assange on a somewhat weak but still sufficient CFAA charge of, you know, you're not a journalist if you sit on IRC and you walk your patsy through dumping the security hive and trying to crack the SAM, right? And that is, you know, that was a pretty, you know, quote unquote clean indictment. The stacking on the espionage is definitely targeted the rest of the US media. I also think like it's tactically stupid, right? Assange is not in the United States yet.
No, this is the crazy thing, right? Is like it was going to be such a straightforward extradition. And my immediate thought was, I don't know that the Brits are going to want to extradite based on these new charges because this thing's just going to get massively political. And when you've got reasonable people who otherwise loathe him saying that this is a terrible, terrible, terrible bad idea, I just think it's going to turn into a shit fight. And what was surprising to me is that was, as I say, it was just my immediate instinct. I don't have any legal training or anything like that. I don't really know the UK extradition process that well. But what did surprise me is I saw a number of prominent legal commentators saying the same thing. So I think this could be shaping up to be an interesting extradition battle. And I'll have to be there saying, hey, UK government, please don't extradite the guy, and that's going to kill me inside.
I'm just trying to figure out why would they do this now when they had him on CFAA. They had a clean reason to get him extradited.
Pompeo,
to massively complicate it.
Pompeo. I mean, he's been really ramping up the rhetoric on this for quite a while. You know, he's Secretary of State. He's very influential within the Trump administration. And this, you know, if you have to ask who's driving this, it's Pompeo.
Right. That is, I guess, the other thing that's going on here is that you have kind of national security professional Republicans in the administration who are not fans of Assange and a president who is a fan. And so I wonder how much of a desire to separate oneself from kind of the pro-Russia side of the current administration is a driver here. I mean, it's hard to tell. It's hard to get in these guys' heads. I think it's totally wrong. And a number of people do. You know, I'm a colleague with Jack Goldsmith, who was in the Bush administration, certainly somebody who understands national security law. And I was with him at an event this week, and we talked about this, and he is clearly believes that this is a direct attack against what the US media does every single day these days.
Yeah. Look, and for people who, and I have seen some people say, well, you know, it wasn't real journalism what he does. Look, it doesn't matter. The fact is that they're charging him for specific actions which journalists do engage in on a fairly regular basis. You know, this is a check and balance on government power that you benefit from. Okay. And when basically every journalist on the planet and a whole bunch of law scholars are telling you there's a problem here, maybe time to listen. As unpalatable as it is, say it with me, Alex, free Julian Assange.
You will not hear me saying that. I'll say drop the superseding indictment. What do we want? CFA charges, but nothing else. When do we want it?
Now.
When legally appropriate.
That's right.
I see people writing up the cardboard signs right now.
Yeah. Look, so there it is. Now, look, another thing that I don't even know that we would have covered this in the show normally if you weren't this week's news guest, but seeing as you are, and you are an ex-Facebook executive.
That's a strong opening right there.
Well, no,
for any topic.
It's interesting, right? Now, there was this video doing the rounds Fairly low circulation, to be honest. It was doing the rounds on sort of conservative social media cliques that showed the US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. What they'd done is they'd slowed down the video, right? And what happens when you slow down someone's video and pitch correct them is they sound drunk, right? So this video was going around as like, oh, look, Nancy Pelosi's drunk and stumbling all around. Now, look, before we get into the discussion, I actually took a 5-minute clip of Trump and I slowed him down just to demonstrate the technique. It's very, very simple. I'm going to play 16 seconds of drunk Trump right here. Here it is.
That's treason. That's treason. And that's what happened. And that's what's happening right now, because without the treason word, I guess, but that's what's happening now. They don't feel they can win the election. So they're trying to do the 1,000 stabs. Keep stabbing. Let's have a financial. Let's have. And if you look.
Anyway, you get the idea, right? So that's what happens when you slow someone down. They always sound drunk. And of course, he was perfectly alert and not at all drunk then, just as Nancy Pelosi was perfectly alert and not at all drunk during this video. But this did turn into a massive controversy, because Facebook's line was, its response was to downrank the video and to place essentially a link over it saying there is additional reporting available about this media. So my view is Facebook is right not to pull it down. You start pulling stuff like that offline, you're going to get all the conspiracy theorists jumping up and down saying it's a giant conspiracy to silence the truth that she's, you know, that she's secretly an alcoholic and whatever. So I think the approach of trying to give people more information is a good one. But I got to say, personally, Alex, I think the warning they put on that video was pretty weak sauce. They said there's additional reporting available. And I get that they want to be neutral, but I would have thought a fairly prominent banner saying this video has been doctored and is misleading with a link to the original video probably would have been a better way to go. What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, so I got a lot of thoughts on this, as you can imagine. So the first big picture, this is a great demonstration of a couple of things we're going to be seeing a lot more of as we head into 2020, which is, first, disinformation is going domestic, right? There's no evidence of any kind of Russian shenanigans or foreign actors. These are politically motivated domestic actors who want to make a point and are doing it via pushing. And I will call it disinformation because it is they intend to mislead. The second is we focus so much on quote unquote deep fakes, that these kinds of shallow fakes, like just editing a video.
I've heard them called cheap fakes.
Cheap fakes. Yeah, that's a better one. Basically anything you can do from iMovie is a bigger risk. And we had this big controversy, that the Covington Catholic controversy, where these teenage boys ran into a Native American elder, and depending on how you cut the video and what framing you put around it, people drew completely different conclusions from a video that had not been modified in any way but editing. And so that is definitely the future. As for Facebook's response, I totally agree with you. I don't think the warning is the right thing. I think what's happened here is they are applying a fact check warning that was created for a different purpose.
Yes.
Which was for if you've got somebody like a Breitbart or some really sketchy pseudo-journalistic outfit.
Yeah, I mean, it's to combat spin, not complete falsehoods, right? So I get that that's an appropriate message when you're dealing with, well, you know, click here for a sort of slightly different take because this one's kind of misleading. Whereas this one was actually falsified evidence supporting a lie, essentially, right? And you need to come out swinging against that. The only reason I can think that they didn't is because Facebook doesn't want to get into the position where they are in and of themselves actually being the arbiters of facts, right? So it's pretty clear to me that that's why they didn't go there, but they should have.
Well, I think the reason the label sucks is that they don't have a product solution for the video specific issue. So my suggestion would be, I think they need a video specific label that you don't need to say disputed, because whether or not a video has been technically edited is not disputable, right? Unlike what might be a spun headline in a in a radical journalistic outfit, if you know something is a face has been replaced, if somebody's voice has been changed, if it's been slowed down, you know that that is technically true. And so I think they need to have a different kind of warning that does the same stuff on the back end, which is reduce sharing. It downranks it newsfeed, makes it more difficult for people to find it.
I couldn't even find it when I went looking for it. So I think to a degree, this has been blown up a little bit out of proportion because people weren't really watching it that much. And then the media got a hold of it and it became a huge thing. And of course, conservative media sharing it, things like that. I think really what we've wound up with here, and I saw a Facebook spokesperson on, I forget her name, but I forgot the name. Yeah. So I saw her going head to head with Anderson Cooper, who was doing, adversarial interview style. Why won't you remove it? Pretty self-righteous stuff. And I don't know, man. I kind of think Facebook, in my mind, has come out looking okay on this one when you really look at how far downranked the video had been. And the Facebook rep made the good point that the discussion across all social media platforms and in the media is about how this video is fake, right?
Right. So if I was them, I would change the warning. I would apply that warning much more aggressively to any kind of video that is a parody or satire. Because the truth is Facebook is full of these kinds of videos about Donald Trump, right? About him being slowed down, about deceptive edits, about like Jimmy Kimmel making jokes. Now, people argue that the Pelosi video was intended to be disinformation other than satire, but realistically, you cannot have these companies trying to determine what is the bounds of political satire. And I strongly, strongly don't think the company should take it down because
neither do I.
You're totally right in that the media is driving people to this video. This would have been a flash in the pan that a couple of true believers, people who hate Nancy Pelosi no matter what, who are not swing voters, right, would have seen, except all day on television, they're talking about there's a video you should not see on Facebook. Please don't go search for it, right? So you have the media driving all of that traffic. And if Facebook took it down, what you would end up having
Alex Jones's head would f***ing explode, man.
Well, so remember, Facebook banned the Christchurch video, which I think was the right move because there is direct evidence that that was intended to get other people to harm people. And there's a direct kind of harm standard you can apply to that. But when they did that, 1.5 million people tried to re-upload it. You would have 10 times as many people as a protest re-uploading modified videos of Nancy Pelosi. And so the only way to fight that would be via machine learning that fingerprints it. The problem here, that was hard enough with the Christchurch video, but at least in that case, the entire video was banned. You cannot write a machine learning algorithm that takes down every reference to Nancy Pelosi that might be slightly misleading. And so if they went as far as to completely squash it using the same kind of ML as they used in Christchurch, you would have a massive swell of people trying to re-upload it and very few tools to take it down because video of Nancy Pelosi talking is a totally reasonable thing to normally have. And these kinds of manipulations might be quite subtle and very difficult for ML to pick out. So I think that the finding the biggest versions of the video, labeling them, again, I would change how the labeling works. I'd be more aggressive about it, and downranking is a smart move. And then I think I would like to see that label in lots of places. Like if I'm watching a Jimmy Kimmel clip where he's making fun of Trump and it's deceptively edited, I think it's totally fine for that to have a label. You don't call it disinformation or false or something, but you have to have a label that says something like, this video has been modified from its original version and maybe it's misleading. And something like that allows for parody and satire to exist while also greatly reducing the chance that anybody takes it seriously.
Yeah, I think this is all going to get pretty complicated. Well, it already is, right? But we got to move on because we've got a whole bunch of other stuff to get through. Moving on, and Amazon shareholders have rejected a motion, I guess, that would have seen the company not sell its facial recognition technology to governments. Facial recognition as a privacy issue, I guess for me, got serious probably somewhere in the order of like 5 to 7 years ago when the technology just became so cheap and viable. And we got a couple of stories this week. We got another one from Lily Hay Newman. In Wired, sort of talking about how maybe we need to regulate this stuff. And I'm kind of on that side of the argument. I'm not normally a regulate everything type of person, but it just feels this technology being everywhere, it feels invasive.
It does. It is invasive. I think we will end up with, if we end up with a federal privacy law, we'll end up with some regulation of the private sector. But what this is mostly talking about is the use of facial recognition by local law enforcement, which is definitely very, very creepy. I understand why the ACLU put this to the Amazon shareholders. It was always going to be just a symbol, because the truth is facial recognition technology is very commoditized at this point. You don't get a huge competitive advantage of getting it from Amazon versus one of a dozen other companies.
But I agree with you, and this is why I think, you know, regulation makes sense.
Yeah, we're going to need some kind of federal regulation about what local cops can do, because there is some, you know, the license plate reader stuff, the other kinds of automated policing that pulls out of people's history was already creepy enough to use people's faces, especially when we also have a lot of history of facial recognition being racially biased, of confusing people if they come from certain racial groups. The fact that facial recognition might then create a person from a racial minority now having an interaction with an armed police officer, that traditionally does not usually end well in the United States. Until this technology is better understood, it needs to be limited, and perhaps limited forever, because there are like some serious Fourth Amendment issues here of what does it mean to search somebody if you are looking at a crowd of 10,000 faces and looking for every single person who might have an outstanding parking ticket warrant.
Yeah.
Right. And but we're going to need federal regulation of what the cops can do. Doing it on a per company basis gets you nothing, right? Like
we need some general regulations here, right? And I think not just in the United States, like you see stories here in Australia about, you know, local governments using this type of technology for various purposes. I mean, like councils, right?
Right.
If there's one privacy issue that really, really bothers me, it is this one. Now, look, staying with the issue of privacy, we've got a really, really interesting bit of research here where apps can essentially fingerprint devices based on the way the sensors are calibrated in them. This affects iOS devices and Android devices. This is fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's another piece of evidence for the theory that modern mobile devices are just state storage stacked on top of more state storage all the way down, right? Like these are not things that are born from the factory completely identical. There's a huge amount of customization that either comes out of the factory in this case, or that happens the first time you use it. And in this case, if you can access the sensors via the normal APIs, I'm not sure any OSs actually require anything for the motion sensors. I believe that is part of the standard permission set for every single app. Then that allows you to fingerprint the phones. Now, that's not a big deal on Android, because the truth is there's a gazillion ways to fingerprint Android, but it is a bigger deal for iOS devices, because Apple has been doing a number of things to try to keep people from persisting identifiers across reinstalls on the same Apple phone. I believe
they've tightened the permissions in light of this research, though. Like they have moved to fix it.
Yeah, it does look like it was fixed in iOS 12.2. I expect there's going to be a bunch more of these.
The interesting thing about this isn't the specific research. It's just that there are these types of fingerprinting techniques that allow people to persistently identify individual bits of hardware across wipes.
Yeah, and it just reminds you of how incredibly complex these devices are, right? That something as simple as the motion sensor is a full-fledged computer that is running like a tiny little operating system that has all of this information about calibration, right? Like it's just, you know, because the number of general purpose CPUs in the device in your pocket is actually spectacular.
Now, look, we're kind of running out of time, so I'm going to skip this one, but I'll leave a note in this week's show notes. I'll leave a link in this week's show notes if people want to check it out. But there's some interesting stuff being pushed by Apple here around privacy preserving ad click attribution for the web. A little bit sort of niche for us when we're running low on time, so we'll just skip that. But turning our attention to Germany, and look, we've seen the interior minister in Germany making some noise about crypto. I mean, it's the typical sort of stuff that you hear government ministers saying. Messages should be decrypted so that law enforcement can access them, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Interior ministers are often who you hear from this in Europe, because they have the local law or the national law enforcement office within the remit. He's basically saying you need a backdoor. In this case, he's not presenting, you know, this is pretty much the argument that the US was making 4 or 5 years ago. So it just seems the Germans are perhaps a little behind, because now American politicians are much more advanced in calling for, you know, super complicated backdoors that they can pretend are secure, where this guy's just saying, record it and send it to us.
Yeah, that's funny, right? I've actually got an interview tomorrow morning with Jim Baker, who's the former lead counsel of the FBI, through right up until the Comey era. And we'll be talking crypto wars. That's going to be an interesting conversation. Funnily enough, you know, we've already already spoken before our recording date, and he's like, "What, the crypto war? We lost that one." So he's got some interesting takes there. So that's going to be a fun chat. That's one of the podcasts that is being that's been commissioned by the Hewlett Foundation. So that one will be edited and published within the next couple of weeks. CyberScoop is reporting that Best Mixer, which is a Bitcoin Tumblr, helped launder. You know, European police have taken it down and they said, oh, it's a money laundering operation. This is interesting, right? Because to my knowledge, we haven't seen tumblers targeted in this way before. And without tumblers, you know, Bitcoin crime gets pretty difficult pretty quickly.
It does. And, you know, this should be a big warning for the tumblers because, you know, all of their, the evidence of their crimes are indelibly written into the blockchain. So yeah, this is a great thing about Bitcoin is if you're running a Tumblr, if you're you're trying to launder Bitcoins, you don't have to be investigated in real time for that. The evidence of that crime is going to last forever.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that's an interesting little development there. Now, China, apparently the Chinese military wants to replace Windows with its own custom OS. And I don't know what to make of this report because they're like, yeah, we're totally going for security through obscurity, which of course isn't going to work because someone's eventually going to get their hands on the OS and tear it to bits. That said, if they're going to do a ground up build of an operating system that has a limited use, there's every chance they could actually do it right.
Yeah, maybe. This feels to me, this looks like an authorized leak. This feels to me part of a tit for tat in response to the Huawei issue. Yeah. That, you know, the Chinese
screw
want
you
to demonstrate.
We're not going to use Windows then. We'll have our own OS.
Yeah, it seems pretty silly. I'm not, you know, I am more interested in the Chinese reaction to what they're going to do to try to build up supply chains and allow Huawei to continue to operate with absolutely no American components in them. That is a much more interesting than this to me because, you know, making your own operating system is easy. There's, you know, there are a bunch of, you know, upper division computer science classes where you create a new operating system as part of the course. Building something that has the network effects that makes it actually usable by both enterprises and consumers is extremely hard.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I am very interested to see if we're going to see a Chinese mobile OS emerge, given everything that's happened with Huawei and ZTE. Krebs on Security is reporting on a pretty monstrous data breach here. This one caused quite a stir when it was broken.
This is huge. Once again, you know, the old school parts of the U.S. economy, including the all of the components necessary to sell a house in the United States, which is, this is one, a company called First American. They're a provider of title insurance. So this is a bizarre service that when you buy or sell a piece of property in the United States, you buy insurance from these folks that basically you're ensuring that the county or the state, whoever is recording who owns land, has not made a mistake, that there's not some kind of person coming out of the back, out of the mist, saying that, you know, they inherited some land. You get this insurance for this very short period of time during which you do the transaction that everything's fine. So it's a kind of ridiculous industry that this has to exist. I've never heard of title insurance actually being paid out in any circumstance. And so these guys are just basically rent collectors, but they're rent collectors that have copies of every single loan application and mortgage application in the United States.
It's not like that information would be useful to criminals or anything though, Alex, right?
Right. And in this case, they had up a website with a straight up sequential integer parameter tampering, the first bug I teach non-computer science students how to do.
Direct
the
object reference for the
class.
Win. Woo.
Right, not just direct object reference. It starts with, like, this guy was showing, you know, a bunch of 0, 7, 5, and then you do 7, 6, and you do 7, 7. It's just amazingly bad. And, you know, to get a little bit on my soapbox, as somebody from a tech company that has made, you know, a lot of mistakes and needs to work better on privacy. The truth is that most of the industries in the United States are way worse than Silicon Valley when it comes to protecting people's privacy. But you're not going to see that, right? Like, Krebs is talking about this, but this did not really hit the press in the United States, even though this is
is there evidence that this information has actually been obtained by nefarious people? Or is it just like, oh, look at them, they're a bunch of dumbasses and this stuff could possibly leak?
No, yeah, there's not. I guess one of the questions in the forensics that have to happen now is whether they have logs that make you feel at all confident in that, right? Like, if they've got that kind of parameter tampering, the ability for somebody to get on the actual machine is probably pretty decent. And if not, if they're not rolling, you know, if they're rolling their logs pretty quickly and this has been up for years, then we'll never have a good idea.
Yeah. Canva in Australia, they're an Australian, you know, graphic design company, 139 million Canva users impacted in a breach. I actually saw the first phase of their notification. The first two paragraphs were like, we're totally excited to be making wonderful solutions for everyone, blah, 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 blah. It was like second or third paragraph is like, and by the way, they since actually sent out a second notification to the remaining users that brought that up the top, but it was disappointing. I got to say, to see a company doing a data breach notification that looked like a marketing email, and most people would have deleted. So there is that. Equifax. This is a really interesting story, right? Moody's has downgraded its outlook for Equifax from stable to negative. But it's the reason for that that's really interesting. It's not because they got breached. It's because they're spending a lot of money on security tech now, right? So yeah. Basically Moody's has looked at it and gone, look at all the money they're spending on security, downgrade, which is, I guess it's just one of those perverse outcomes you get, you know, on financial markets. It makes sense, I guess, but geez, you see this and you're like, oof.
Yeah, I think we underestimate how much of our problems in the United States, especially right now, are based upon the short-term outlook of Wall Street and how that motivates every public company in every sector.
Because really, the message this sends is don't spend heaps of money on cybersecurity and also don't get breached, right? Which you can't kind of have both. It's just, it is a weird signal.
Yeah, and it was pretty clear after the breach happened, that was a existential breach. That was a breach that, if not handled correctly, could end the company. Clearly, they're going to spend a huge percentage of the revenue on upgrading their security over the next couple of years. That should have been completely foreseeable. It's a little bizarre. It's a bizarre decision by Moody's. You know, clearly, the downgrade should have happened the moment the breach happened.
Yes,
right?
I agree. And that would send the correct signal, right? Not now, where they're actually spending money on remediation and upgrades.
Yeah. That being said, I find it highly unlikely that this is going to, you know, if you're on the outside, what this is probably saying to most CEOs and boards is that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If you spend the money up front, then nobody notices. It's only after a breach that you end up having to tell the world that you're spending $200 million on security upgrades.
Yeah, that's it. Final story this week, Alex. Back in 2017, NSS Labs released one of their endpoint security product test reports. Pissed off CrowdStrike something awful because apparently they disabled a bunch of the like protective measures that are normally switched on with CrowdStrike. I think CrowdStrike sued NSS and said, you're a bunch of liars. Meanwhile, NSS has sued a bunch of endpoint software makers, endpoint security software makers, saying that you're colluding to stop us doing this testing. After a whole bunch of courtroom antics, NSS has published what it is called a corrective statement, which is an apology to CrowdStrike for smudging the test results to make them look bad. We spoke about this, I think, at the time, Adam and I, and about how NSS's reports are often a little bit on the shady side. What did you make of this?
Yeah, so one, NSS is trying to do something very difficult, right? Which is you're trying to test all of these products in an environment that's supposed to reflect real-world conditions, and that is difficult no matter what. But especially in the kind of ML-based model, creating the scenario that these folks are building towards is going to be really hard. In this case, I think CrowdStrike was probably especially angry because they just filed their S-1 right in May. They are going public. They have announced as such 10 days ago. And so to have kind of the NSS issue hanging out there as a possible strike against them that investors might pick up on, I think is the kind of thing that they wanted to clear the table. So I expect that was the driving force here. I love these paragraphs because clearly this whole thing is written by lawyers and has been negotiated. And so for NSS to say, NSS extends its sincere apology to CrowdStrike, because there's nothing more sincere than apology that has been extracted forced through millions of dollars of litigation.
Yeah, I mean, you can read the gritted teeth, right? Like in the in the statement.
But look,
this isn't the first time that we've seen NSS put out reports that are hogwash, really. I think there was something similar with Juniper, years and years ago. But it's like, it just seems like they're the ones who tend to put out stuff that vendors get really upset about and make good points. Like, hey, you know, you disabled a whole bunch of these checkbox options. Of course our product didn't test well. It just seems like they're a company where this tends to happen more than at others, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I can't really think of other companies that are doing the exact same thing, right? Like, I think one of their problems is they're trying to do too much, right? If you look at their test categories, effectively, you know, half of the security industry falls within their remit of them to be testing. It's just unlikely that you could be expert in all of the different scenarios for all of these different products. Everybody wants to be the underwriters' laboratories, right? The thing is UL is paid out of a big fund that everybody throws into, and they don't care what individual companies think about them. And so it's, you know, on a market as and while the security market is huge, the number of critical players is actually like a couple dozen. Yeah. In that kind of market, I think it's very difficult to have a business model like NSS's and still be independent.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Alex, that's it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us and filling in for Adam. It's always a pleasure to chat to you. And yeah, I hope we can do it again later this year.
Thanks so much, Patrick.
That was Alex Stamos there, filling in for Adam Boileau. And big thanks to Alex for finding time for us this week. We always love having him on the show. Now, before we move on, I just want to say that I think debate around that New York Times story is great, but I've seen a lot of people making it pretty personal. So just want to say, while I got the microphone in front of me, let's play the ball and maybe don't make the attacks against Nicole Perlroth's work so personal, because I just think that, you know, I don't think anyone engaging in those sort of personal attacks has come out of this looking particularly shiny. So let's just keep playing the ball. Last week I published a soapbox edition from VMRay with Carsten Willems, who's the co-founder and CEO. If you haven't checked that one out, go have a listen, because it is actually quite... it's quite a fun one, right? Like, it's a sponsored podcast, but it is a fun one. Carsten knows a lot about sandboxes. He's been playing around with them for forever. And if you do work in incident response and you want to throw some samples at VMRay's malware analyzer, you can for free. Just head to vmray.com/trial and that'll get you a 30-day free trial. We will jump into this week's sponsor interview in just a moment. But before we do, we've got a job listing. Google is still looking for detection and response engineers to fill positions in Sydney. There are two roles they're looking to fill: security engineer detection and security engineer security and privacy incident response. The detection engineer role is about creating advanced and novel detection mechanisms to detect malicious insiders and outsiders. The detection team develops new detection logic, tools, and infrastructure to help Google find new and evolving threats. The response role is more of a DFIR type of gig, but dealing with a broader set of issues at Google scale. This role looks at outside and inside threats. And I've linked through to the full job descriptions in this week's show notes, so you can check them out there. Okay, this week's sponsor interview is with David Warburton, a threat research evangelist at F5. Now, I'm guessing pretty much everyone working in IT or security who listens to this show knows who F5 are. They're best known for making load balancers. You know, often people use their WAF module in those load balancers. They also make, you know, SSL terminators, that sort of stuff, network stuff. But as we've chronicled here on risky.biz, growth in the sales of that type of equipment has basically flatlined as everyone transitions to the cloud. Now, that's not to say there isn't still strong demand for data center gear, but it's not exactly the business of the future. So F5 is transforming itself, basically. It dropped $670 million very recently on acquiring Nginx, the company Nginx, which is behind the Nginx web tech. And they're trying to sort of transform themselves into a cloud-relevant tech company. David Warburton joined me for this interview, and I started off by asking him if these moves are born of cold, hard necessity. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. I think part of it is obviously the company. It's F5, and Francois is the new CEO of that company, looking forward in terms of, you know, where the company needs to be in 5, 10 plus years time. You know, we're going to see legacy applications deployed on-prem for a good long time yet. You know, the next sort of 10, 20 years, you know, even applications that have already been deployed are going to still reside on-prem for, again, the next sort of 10 plus years. So those applications are going to continue to need security services and application services.
But you don't want to be in a dying industry at the same time, right?
No, like, absolutely. Yeah. And most of the people we're talking to now, whilst it's not necessarily, you know, the entire focus for an organization, they do have teams popping up, some far more mature than others. Obviously the DevOps crowd that are, you know, deploying their applications using agile methodology in clouds and using architectures that are relatively new for traditional hardware and network security vendors. So I would say over the past 2-3 years at least, we've had a very kind of quick and rapid pivot in terms of, you know, recognizing that we need to be able to offer these services in different ways and make them far easier to consume. Because what we found actually is that whilst those DevOps teams have been happy, you know, spinning up open source software and orchestrating things in various, you know, multiple cloud environments, when we talk to security teams, if they've not been baked into that DevOps team, they have completely different security solutions and security postures dependent on who's developed the apps and where it resides. So, you know, we've got customers with their legacy apps on-prem that have got, you know, traditional defense in depth and multiple hardware and software security vendors. But actually those new applications that go into cloud in a lot of cases look completely different from a security point of view. And so it's those conversations, I would say, that are really driven more than anything the focus for F5.
Mm. So, I mean, you know, look, we do fall into the trap on this program of really talking about, you know, doing security in a way that is, to a large number of organizations out there, it's science fiction, right? Like there is no way that they're going to be doing everything in all singing, all dancing, beyond corpy, totally audited lockdown applications with multi-factor everything, right? So I do recognize that there's a long tail there. There's, you know, it's going to be a while before people are out of the data center, but that's where F5 has traditionally lived, right? You're building a data center. That's when you're going to go to a vendor like F5 and you're going to be like, I need my, you know, ASIC-based load balancers and my SSL termination into my data center. So, you know, you've mentioned a pivot, but we don't really know what that is now, right? Like right now. So tangibly, like, what does that pivot look like? What are the products and services that F5 is going to offer that is not about the data center, that are not about the data center? Because it's a big shift for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say actually that, you know, our view of this isn't actually about the data center at all now. It's really let's give consumers of network and application security services the choice to deploy what they want, where they want it. So for a long time now, we've kind of taken the intellectual property and all the good security modules and things that we've had on the F5 platforms and made them available as virtual editions. Now, that's fine, but that's still fairly sort of data center centric.
Well, you know, we've seen a bunch of people sort of take their network security solutions and try to just transpose them into cloud environments and not really update the thinking behind the products. And as a result, they're not really selling many of them, right? So how do you actually become sort of cloud relevant?
So there's a few things that we've done that I think are very important. From the virtual edition point of view, people that want to deploy it in a slightly more traditional way, we've actually made it easy to consume. So one of the, as well as just making the platform virtual, we've removed barriers, things like licensing and API access, which were still big blockers for people that wanted to orchestrate and use APIs to deploy our products. That was really difficult a couple of years ago. Now, you know, when we've got our systems engineers going out, meeting customers, giving demos, most of those demos are API driven. You know, most of them are using things like CloudFormation templates to push, you know, a full application stack, including multi-scaling F5 services to multiple cloud providers. So providing API access and really making it, you know, integrate into that DevOps tool chain was a big change. So, you know, you can go to Ansible and look, and I think we're the second or third biggest vendor in terms of Ansible playbooks that have been created for F5 products and services.
So, So say I'm running a DevSecOps environment, like how am I using F5 as that bridge between, you know, something that I'm developing in-house and then pushing that out to the cloud? Like where is F5 in that process now? Because, you know, I'm a little foggy on the details, that's all.
Sure. So we can integrate, I mean, some of the demos that we run recently, for example, are integrating F5 using our web app firewall. So part of the F5 product is the web app firewall. And we integrate that into the DevOps lifecycle. So for example, you can push some code changes, you know, you can push code commit via Slack. That'll kick off a Jenkins job. It will deploy the code to live application servers or to production or test application servers. At the same time, it will then also automatically update the relevant web app firewall policies. It can then push that through a test, make sure the tests are successful with the new WAF policies. And if things fail, it will roll the changes back and all of this stuff gets updated to the regular kind of communications and orchestration things, whether it be Slack or some other method.
So really, this is about taking, the WAF approach of the past and actually trying to turn that into something that's incorporated in the development process.
Yeah, absolutely. But we're really cognizant, of course, that, you know, it's one thing making access to our services and to the WAF easier via APIs and, you know, building it into to orchestration tool chains. But actually, WAFs are still fairly complex to manage and deploy, as I'm sure you know. Anything that is really, it's worth its weight requires pretty detailed knowledge of how web app firewalls work. And if they don't require knowledge, then typically they're using signatures and, you know, there'll be lots of things that are missed and they're easy to bypass. So a lot of what we're trying to do is just make it easier for non-WAF specialists to actually get, you know, accurate and realistic and useful blocking web app firewall policies that are just more automated. So whilst we can kind of have WAF policies or application services deployed via APIs, actually the rules and the policies that block certain traffics are learned automatically, you know, through behaviors and through just kind of live interaction with those web services.
And where is this WAF in the new model? Because it's obviously not hardware sitting in your data center.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So in most traditional cases, it's hardware virtual on-prem. It can be virtual in AWS, in Azure, in Google, in all the major cloud platforms. But it could also be potentially one of our new cloud service offerings. So we run Silverline, which is a fully managed and fully hosted web app firewall and DDoS scrubbing center. Or it could be part of the new F5 as a service platform.
So you're like doing like a Cloudflare, but without the Nazis?
No comment, but yes. So we have some very large scrubbing centers across the globe that would allow you to, we either have a kind of fully managed, fully automated system to scrub traffic and to obviously to try and block denial of service traffic. But we also have much simpler, what we call WAF Express. So a bit more basic, but far easier and far quicker to kind of onboard and just get running with it.
So look, it sounds like what you're doing here is you've gone from a position where you were competing with companies like Cisco, Juniper, right? And now you're competing with, I guess, Signal Sciences, Akamai, right? Like, is that what this transformation is looking like for you?
I would say possibly. You know, our focus really is application services and adding value to delivering an application, but specifically from a personal point of view, at least, if you look into that, a big value add is security. Because load balancing has been commoditized for a while. And obviously, the F5 big IP platform's been, you know, far more than just a basic load balancer. But essentially, a lot of people are trying to consume services easier. And a big part of that is maybe taking cloud service providers up on their offer of embedded services. So using things like the application layer gateway and such in Azure, for example, to do some fairly basic, I don't think it's unfair to say, load balancing. So what we can really then add is all the really deep, detailed knowledge that we've had for, I guess, 20 years of delivering applications to actually help secure those. So it's adding security both from an inbound AppSec point of view, but also an outbound AppSec point of view, and then some newer solutions that actually help deliver security to endpoints as well and prevent things like form jacking and credential theft.
Now, you would have to admit that this is a fairly dramatic pivot, right? Like, this is a big change for F5, right? Can we agree to that?
Yeah, I would absolutely.
Now, look, another thing, and we're not going to dwell on this too much because it hasn't been pushed through, but it looks like, you know, F5 is in, has agreed to acquire Nginx for $500 million, right? Now, I'm imagining that this is pretty key. Well, even if it's not key to your plans, like it gives the listeners a bit of insight into, you know, just sort of how much firepower you're willing to put behind this change.
Absolutely. And actually, as of just a few days ago, Nginx is now officially part of F5.
It did close.
It's all closed, it's all official. So we're all, I think it's fair to say both sides of this, both F5 and Nginx employees are really, really excited. I've got to say, I've never actually had or felt so much excitement within F5 over the past 7 years I've been there. So it's a very exciting time. And I think, to your point, you know, we've had, you know, to give one example of an area where this perfect crossover, we talk DevOps now. We provide much easier access to deploy our services, but we're not necessarily at the right injection point to secure all applications with new architectures, so things like microservices. And this is where NGINX perfectly kind of fits what we do. So we can bring the strong app security. NGINX fills, you know, bridges the divide of kind of things like microservices and different teams talking to perimeter and application security guys. And there's just this perfect kind of synergy between the two. API security for me is a really exciting time because although we've had some pretty strong application or API security solutions for a while from, you know, inspection of payload and authenticating APIs, what NGINX is going to allow us to do is, you know, apply that AppSec and that security and those policies, regardless of how the app's deployed and where it's deployed and, you know, whether using...
Well, I mean, look, you know, of all of the stuff that we've talked about, I mean, this is the part that I find most interesting, right? Like, do you remember the monorail episode of The Simpsons? You know, a town yes. with money's a little like the mule with a spinning wheel. No one knows how he got it and danged if he knows how to use it, right? Like, I kind of feel like, you know, I hope like F5 could be the mule with the spinning wheel with NGINX, and already you're telling me what the plan is there. So it seems like there's a pretty clear vision for what you're going to do with it. And the play is definitely like, I mean, it's a web server, right? And it's a popular, incredibly popular web server. And, you know, that puts you into all sorts of interesting places. I mean, that makes you about the most relevant company on the planet right now.
I would agree. I think NGINX is hugely popular. You know, what I've been personally been really pleased to hear is the ongoing commitment from both sides that we're going to remain and, you know, keep developing the open source part of NGINX, because obviously that's how it's gained so much market share. But I think, you know, we've already fronted, you know, all our marketing and salesy stuff will talk about how many of the top 50, top 100, you know, global companies we sit in front of and secure. But things aren't changing, you know, exactly to your point. You know, that model is changing very rapidly. So I think it just brings together the best of both worlds.
It's an interesting position to be in, which is to be that sort of mid-tier vendor, right? Because you're not a Cisco, but you're not some shit-kicking startup either, right? And you can drop $500 million on NGINX, and you're probably one of the only companies in the world that would A, need to do this, and B, actually be able to execute it.
Absolutely. And I think timing's very important. You know, we've made some acquisitions over the years. You know, we don't go out and kind of slurp up any little startup that looks kind of interesting. We definitely take our time and make sure it's going to be a right fit, both, I'd say, technology and solution-wise, but also culturally. And like I said, NGINX just seems like a perfect fit for F5.
All right. Well, we'll be paying a lot of attention to what actually happens on the NGINX side and, you know, all across the board, because I understand that, you know, there is the hardware business. It's not like the hardware business doesn't exist anymore, right? Like, I'm sure you're turning a great buck on that. But it's interesting to see that you've recognized that will atrophy, because it will. And now we've got $500 million acquisitions into web servers. You know, we've got the cloudification of the WAF products. It sounds like, you know, there's a really interesting change going on at F5. And, you know, I'll be certainly keeping an eye on it and curious to see where it's all going to land. David Warburton, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was David Warburton there. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to F5 for being this week's Risky Business sponsor. And let's see how they go with this. Sounds like they're not going with most companies' plan A, which would mean just sticking their heads in the sand and ignoring what's happening. So, yeah, interesting times. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.